Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Lillian Nakagawa, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. Tonight's program is India's Economic Growth, What Can We Expect? By Dr. Nivakar Singh, PhD, Professor of Economics, UC Santa Cruz, author, member of advisory group to the Finance Minister of India on G20 matters. This program is part of the club's India Now program, sponsored by gold sponsor Wells Fargo Bank and silver sponsor Ernst & Young. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. As an expert on economics in India, Dr. Singh is very active in many different arenas as a professor, author, columnist, speaker, and advisor to the Indian government, as well as to companies in the private sector. He holds an endowed chair as a professor of economics at the University of California at Santa Cruz, where he also directs the Business Management Economics Program and the South Asian Studies Initiative. In addition, he is a member of the advisory group to the Indian Finance Minister on G20 matters. He is the author or co-author of over 100 research papers and 3 books, and is a widely read columnist in one of India's oldest financial newspapers. You can easily find his columns on the website of the newspaper, The Financial Express, including a recent one called Getting India to 10% Growth. His research topics include political economy, economic development, high tech and innovation, information technology, and the Indian economy. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and his bachelor's and master's degrees from the London School of Economics. Please welcome Dr. Singh to this podium.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, and I'm really delighted to be speaking at such an august institution as the Commonwealth Club. Given the events of the last few days, I was thinking on the way over that perhaps I should be talking about the U.S. economy. But I guess one of the things we're learning is that the major economies of the world are increasingly interconnected, and that includes the United States, Europe, China, and more India. Gently dissuaded from using any PowerPoints, so I won't show you any graphs or numbers, which is probably a good thing, though I'm sure this won't be as exciting as the spices of India and henna coming up. Nevertheless, hopefully by the time I'm done, you'll have some idea of where India might be going and why. So I'll start out with some very basic background. I'm sure a lot of you already have this information, but it will just allow me to sort of set the stage. So as you know, India is by now probably the largest country in the world in terms of population. It's also a democracy, which is very unusual for a country at India's income levels. It also has a federal structure. So one way I like to describe India is that India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh, has a population comparable to that of Brazil. Smaller Indian states have populations greater than most European countries. So when one talks about India, one is speaking about a very large and heterogeneous nation. You're also familiar with India's history. It was a British colony for a couple of hundred years, effectively. It was partitioned in 1947. And when India began to have an independent existence, by the way, the 64th anniversary of India's independence is coming up. It's Monday, August 15th. When India became independent, of course, one of the primary concerns of its leaders, besides creating political stability, was to promote economic development. India was very much a poor country in 1947, and one of the primary goals of its political leaders was to correct that and take India out of poverty. The record was not as wonderful as one might have hoped, given India's initial conditions. For several decades, India grew at about 3 or 4% a year. If you subtract population growth, that meant that per capita incomes were going up at just 1 or 2% a year, which was really not sufficient to make any dent in poverty. Now, when India started its economic policies, independent economic policies, of course, the world was very different. There was a lot of emphasis on economic planning, on centralized economic management. And, of course, we still have these debates 7 decades later. But in India's case, while it was able to maintain and certainly strengthen its political side, its democracy, it really suffered in terms of not growing as rapidly as it might have. The benchmark against one which one can compare India was not so much the historical experience of the West, which actually did not grow that rapidly, but the experience of the East Asian countries, China, Japan, Korea, and much later China. It was really, I think, the realization that you could have countries growing year after year at 10% a year that really lit a fire under India's leadership. In 1991, then, India undertook a program of economic reform, and that included opening up international trade, removing a lot of trade restrictions, and removing a lot of domestic controls on Indian industry. And I think it's academics argue about the causality, but certainly India saw after 1991 an acceleration in its growth rate from the 3 or 4% per year that I'd been speaking of to more like 5, 6, 7, then 8. And finally, in the last few years, before the financial crisis hit everybody, India had crossed 9% growth for 3 years in a row. Still below the East Asian miracle rates of growth, but much better than India had achieved in the past. Now, if you look at, again, what was the nature of Indian growth? I think besides political stability, India has also been able to maintain macroeconomic stability. It's managed its fiscal deficits reasonably well. It's managed inflation reasonably well. And that has actually been a contributor to India's recent good economic performance. On the other hand, there are some concerns about whether Indian growth is sustainable. And I think that's what always makes one ask the question about what one can expect about India's. Nobody seems to think that China will have any problem growing at 10%, 12%, though now they also may be facing some constraints. But if you look at India in detail, it almost seems like, well, where is this growth coming from? How is India managing it? It's a messy democracy. It's not, authoritarian government like China, which can change things, move direction on a dime from leadership from the top. But instead, everything has to be done by consensus. It's a very diverse country with a lot of vertical and horizontal divisions and cleavages. So it always seems like, well, how is India managing this? Will it be able to sustain it? India always seems to be somewhat fragile. But when you look at the economic record, so I mentioned 1991 as a watershed year in terms of changing the direction of economic policy, India over the last two decades has been consistently one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And I think just to give you a hint of I will conclude with, I think India actually will not have any problem growing at 8% a year in the future. The hard part will be getting to 10% growth, the article that Ms. Nakagawa mentioned. One way to think about why I think that 8% growth is relatively sustainable is if you look at what has happened to India's savings and investment rates. And again, this is sort of basic dry economics, but one of the main drivers of growth is simply investment. You get growth through investment. And where does the investment come from? It comes from saving. India actually does not rely very much on foreign saving. It is increasingly getting flows of investment, both in terms of investment in its stock market and direct investment, you know, for bricks and mortar type of things. But India has relied largely on the savings of its own people. And one of the things that has also made that possible is the rise of a middle class in India that has the classic virtues of thrift of the middle class. So India's saving rate has in the last few years crossed 30%, which is, you know, well short of China's 45-50%, but a saving rate of 30-35% is certainly sufficient for maintaining 8% growth. And barring some issues that I'll come to, I don't see that equilibrium being disturbed. Again, the challenge will be to accelerate beyond 8%. And I'll say at the end why I think 8% now is not enough, even though it's a lot better than 3 or 4% that India saw for several decades. Now, some of the problems with India's growth are that it hasn't really grown in the classic way, if you like. It hasn't followed a pattern that has been followed by almost every developing economy, or one can even identify in the rise of the West a couple of centuries ago, namely building up manufacturing. So economic growth typically, traditionally, has come from industrialization, which means manufacturing. And then when an economy gets richer, as the United States, you move beyond manufacturing into services. 75% or more of the U.S. economy is services. And sometimes we worry about that, you know, about the U.S. not having manufacturing. But in some sense, from an economist's point of view, that's a natural evolution. It makes more sense to get your manufacturing done where it's cheaper, a lot of it that is routine, and then use your resources for things that you can't import, like a lot of services. So what is interesting is that India is actually has an economy which is over 60% services at much lower levels of income than the United States. In that sense, it's a very unusual pattern of growth, a pattern of development. I'll talk about the reasons for that in a moment, but manufacturing then in India is a relatively small share of the economy. It's still only about less than 20% of the economy, and the rest, of course, is agriculture. Agriculture is still the major employer of people in India. I think it accounts for still over half of employment in India. That is an issue because if you're going to grow and you have a population growing at 1 to 2% a year, you have to be able to give people jobs. I mean, the United States, of course, we're very concerned right now about jobs, and I think that is one of the areas where it does seem like having some more manufacturing in the United States would be good to have those kinds of jobs. But India is at the moment not really creating enough of those kinds of factory jobs which can pull in unskilled, semi-skilled workers from the farm into the cities and into factories. And that's, of course, the classic pattern of economic growth of industrialization. So India is, in some senses, too skill-intensive, too capital-intensive. It's not creating employment rapidly enough, and yet it's still growing at 8% growth. But the not creating enough jobs, as in any country, is going to create political challenges, and that's something that the Indian government is paying attention to, and I'll describe how. One of the main characteristics of India right now is that it's a relatively young country, unlike, say, China, which is already aging because of its one-child policy. India actually is seeing a bulge move into the working age years, much as we had the baby boom in the United States. Sort of what we're seeing in India. And that if those people can be productively employed actually provides what we call a demographic dividend. It actually boosts economic growth maybe by 1 or 2 percentage points. So again, that can be a plus if policy works, if the economy is creating jobs. It can be a negative if those jobs aren't there. And instead, when you have a lot of young people without jobs, what you get is a political unrest. And we've seen that in different ways in the Middle East, in Europe, and so on. I'm not saying that that's the only cause of the unrest. Obviously, there are political factors as well. But not having a job is really not a good thing when you're young, and not having a job for years. I'll say a little bit more about the Indian economy in terms of. So I've said it's services intensive, and one aspect of those services, of course, is software, and software has been, I think, extremely important for India, much more than its contribution to the gross national product, which is maybe just 3, 4, 5%, something like that. But it was the software industry that first demonstrated that India could be world class in something modern. India, of course, has a very rich culture, great heritage of music, art, and so on. But that was all heritage. It was in the past. And really, it was the rise of the Indian software industry that demonstrated not only to the rest of the world, but to Indians that India could compete with the best in the modern world. Now, the software industry has had some important impacts in India. The revenues generated by the software industry and the contribution to the Indian economy now have actually been dwarfed by what in India is called information technology-enabled services, ITES. And that includes everything from call centers to more complex forms of business process outsourcing. It includes doing medical records. Now we're also seeing accounting and legal services being done in India. So this is something that has really been fueled by the initial success of the software industry. Now, a lot of that IT-enabled services, as the name suggests, has been built on the foundation of the IT industry, of the software industry, using software to offer these kinds of services. But also what the software industry showed is how one can organize production efficiently for these different services. And it also established a reputation. So before the software industry came up, India was not viewed as a very attractive place to invest, to contract out, and so on. But the track record there has really changed. So sometimes people talk about, well, India and China as twins in that respect, where manufacturing is being outsourced to China and services being outsourced to India, and you get that kind of complementarity. It's more complicated than that. The software industry and the management expertise that has been honed in that industry that went into services also has started to filter into manufacturing. So now you do have some Indian manufacturing firms in areas such as automobile components that are world-class, that have won Japanese quality awards. And so that's one ray of hope for manufacturing in India, which would, I think, help in terms of contributing positively to growth. Other aspects of the Indian economy that I think are particularly strong: India has a very robust financial sector. It has a stock market infrastructure, for example, again built on information technology, that is absolutely world class, as good as what you have on Wall Street or in the city of London. And so parts of the financial sector in India are, I think, extremely they are poised to compete at a world level. They're, I think, obviously have to compete with established financial centers such as Hong Kong, Singapore, and now Shanghai coming up. But the financial sector in India is certainly one of its positives. If you look at other sectors, I think there's perhaps less room for optimism. India's infrastructure is well known to be lagging behind its development. It's much poorer than China's. India is struggling to deal with that. One of the main problems is in the generation of electric power. There are chronic shortages of electric power, for example, and that has a very adverse effect on economic activity, obviously. India also hasn't done as good a job as it might have, should have, in terms of education and health. And again, you have to obviously control for the level of income, the standard of living. But if you compare India with countries that are at similar per capita incomes, India's levels of basic health and education leave something to be desired, and they lag far behind China's, for example. And this is very important for economic growth, because ultimately economic growth comes not from the physical investments. Obviously, the physical investments are the proximate driver of growth, but ultimately economic growth comes from the abilities of a country's people, and their innovativeness, ingenuity, their ability to do things. And if somebody is illiterate, malnourished, obviously you're putting them in a very substantial hole in terms of their ability to participate in a modern economy. And this is something that India is still struggling with after many, many decades. India is another area that is booming in the Indian economy is construction. There's a lot of money going into real estate. That, in some sense, is again, I think it's perhaps some human condition of fascination. Land used to be the source of all wealth, when we were an agricultural society, when we were all agricultural societies, and land in some sense is still crucial, whether it's used for farming or for building factories or for roads and so on. And we've seen real estate booms across the world. India is no stranger to that. And I think a lot of that is positive. Again, one is developing a lot of low-income housing in India. Again, there are dangers in real estate booms, as we've seen in the United States. Other area that I think will be very interesting in India is retail. And India right now is actually, I have mixed feelings about this. India right now is sort of like Japan. Japan has very fragmented retailing. It has deliberately kept retailing traditional in some ways. Mom and pop shops, stores and so on have flourished in Japan and been protected. And Indian retailing is very much like that. India has kept large foreign retailers out, except in a very limited way. But now the government is seriously considering opening up foreign investment in retail. So that means Walmart. So you also might have mixed feelings about Walmart coming into your neighborhood, and I think the Indians will have to see how it goes. The obvious benefit of that is that bringing in large retailers dramatically can improve supply chain efficiencies, and that could be very important in India. And one area where India is extremely weak is actually in its agricultural supply chain. So not only is Indian agriculture not very productive by global standards, but there are a lot of inefficiencies in getting the agricultural products to the market. And sometimes that's, just fresh stuff rots. Sometimes it's not processed. The facilities aren't there for processing it, preserving it, and so on. So the hope is that large players coming in at the retail end will then make investments, backwards investments along the supply chain. And that might actually ultimately improve efficiency of agricultural production itself. And there has been some of that in India, but not enough. Now, that's maybe more detail than you wanted about the Indian economy. Let me now say something about where India is going. Right? And here are some canaries in the coal mine that you can keep an eye on to get a sense of where India is going. I said, well, 8% doesn't seem like a problem, but there are always things that can go wrong, right? We've seen that again and again in the last few years, where we keep getting blindsided by events that we never expected. What one author has called black swans, I think they're getting too frequent now to be called black swans. So we live in this world of uncertainty. So what can you look at in terms of seeing where India is going? So forget all this detailed stuff I said about the economy. I've tried not to give you too many numbers. So what can you look at? One, I think, is actually just follow the rise of Indian multinationals. And again, this is sort of, India is a little different from China, I think, because it is a democracy. I think people are, in some senses, Indians are not as disciplined, perhaps, as Chinese. I mean, to use just a very general stereotype, you go to an Indian city, it's always a mess. It's never, clean, and so on. But you also have a lot of positive energy, and where that has been coming up in the last decade or two is in firms like Tata and Reliance and new firms. You see it in the software firms as well. And these firms are actually buying, investing abroad and trying to build global presences. One of the examples was Tata, which is one of the oldest Indian firms, buying Jaguar and Rover from the British. The timing wasn't that great, but they've actually turned it around and are making a success of it. So I think, watch that. And some of it, you see the news about lavish weddings and so on of the new rich in India. But there's also a lot of energy in terms of trying to get things done. And there's more colorful personalities, really, from coming out of India, perhaps, than out of China. I think that Chinese billionaires are maybe more shy, or they prefer not to be in the limelight, perhaps because of the domestic political system. In India, actually, and this is a cultural change in India now. Well, Deng Xiaoping said in 1978, it's glorious to get rich, and the Indians are still dealing with that. They're still accepting that, but more and more in India, it's fine to be rich, and it's something to aspire towards. If you want to see where India is going, another canary in the coal mine is the state of Bihar. Bihar is in northeastern India. It's in some ways the cradle of much of modern Indian civilization. The first Indian empires really arose there in Bihar. For India's recent past, post-independence, it has been India's poorest state. It has been lawless. It has been riven by conflict. And things have started to turn around in Bihar. It's been growing well. The state chief minister, so that would be like something like a governor of a U.S. state, got reelected for governing well, not for what caste he was, or not for promising favors like free electricity or water, but actually for doing the basic things that government does. So I think if one watches Bihar, you really get a sense of where India is going. On the other hand, something to watch, which is two things that are related, or symptoms of political unrest or political dangers. One is internal, which is India has what we call a Maoist rebellion going on throughout much of eastern India. These are tribal areas, forested. A lot of it is actually triggered by the fact that much of India's mineral wealth is in these regions, and companies are coming in and mining and taking the wealth out, giving very little to the locals. So this distributional issue, which is a general problem in India, as India has grown more rapidly, you've seen a rise in inequality, much as you have in China, and I think it's one of the characteristics, perhaps, of the first stage of growth. And looking at patterns of growth, typically what you see is rising inequality. Then if the people have their act together, they figure out a way of sharing the wealth so that you have some kind of internal social and political stability. And that, of course, is something that India is trying. The Chinese, I think, still have to work that out, because up to now they've been able to do it just simply because of the nature of their government. But I think they're going to have to address this in China as well. But in India, you have a Maoist rebellion, and this is sort of ironic, right, because Mao is forgotten in China, but the Indian revolutionaries within India are always known as Maoists, and it goes back to the 60s when they did follow Mao's Little Red Book and so on. So this is a serious symptom of, I think, some of the internal tensions that rapid growth and rising inequality are creating in India. I think the other political challenge, of course, is what is happening in India's neighbors. And India's rapid growth recently has taken it far ahead of Pakistan and Bangladesh, the two main neighbors. China is also a neighbor, but in a different category. And I think India will have to address this. And it's not easy for India because I think Pakistan in particular, as you know, is extremely unstable. It has a lot of internal problems with its polity. And I think India has to work very hard to deal with some of the instability in Pakistan that spills over into India. I'm mainly trying to talk about economics, so I won't say more about that. But obviously, these are two nuclear countries. If you get into that kind of conflict mode, then all bets are off in terms of economic growth, right? I mean, that's a doomsday scenario. One thing that doesn't get much headlines, but I think is very important in India, is basically what the government is doing is rewriting the legal structures. And a lot of India's laws were inherited from the British. You know, the many laws which go back to the mid-19th century when the British Crown formally took over in India. But often those laws are completely outdated, and India is actually embarking on a major rewrite of corporate law, of laws governing land acquisition. Labor laws are also always on the agenda, difficult to tackle, because of internal politics. But if one digs deep, one sees that there is really a lot of change that is going on at the behind the scenes. And so sometimes one reads about, well, India has stopped reforming, nothing is happening, they're just busy dealing with corruption scandals. But actually, a lot of reform is going on. There's also an attempt to modernize completely financial sector regulation. And I predict that when the Indians are done with their rewriting of financial sector regulation, that actually that will have some good lessons for perhaps the United States and Europe in terms of how to do it, because there's some very smart people in India working on this, and very passionate people also. And I think that's one of the things that I think has changed also in India over the last couple of decades, is this, I was talking about software and feeling of being world class. I think this sort of resurgence of national pride in a good way. maybe a final indicator that I can mention, and this is something that where I've been somewhat disappointed. This is something that the World Bank produces. It's called the Ease of Doing Business Index, and it's very complicated, but ultimately it produces a ranking of 180 plus countries, and India has been pretty much static at around 130. Of course, the top countries are the U.S., Singapore, Hong Kong, and so on. And China is maybe around 70 or 80. But India has not been moving. And I think a lot of that has to do with the laws, regulations, corruption. So those things, I think the Indian government really has to address. Indian multinationals are doing well. Large firms are doing well. What India needs is more small business creation. And again, just to use an analogy, this is one of the major problems in the United States, is interest rates are low, but small businesses cannot get credit. And so you're not seeing job creation precisely because you're not seeing small business creation and small business expansion in the United States. And that's, I think, a phenomenon that is, it's nothing to do with the level of income, it's nothing to do with culture, it's economics, that these are the kinds of businesses that create jobs. So I think India has to figure out some way of making it easier to do business, to create new businesses, and this I think will also address some of the aspects of the demographic dividend, creating jobs. India also has to and is trying to address its education sector. There's an attempt to reform higher education, to open it up to private players. It's been very heavily restricted and controlled by the government. And India has been following a skill-intensive pattern of growth, but it's also suffering from very severe skill shortages. So I'm telling my students now, if you can't get a job here, go to India. There's a desperate shortage, and you'll do very well in India. There's all kinds of skills. People, and it's easier than going to China because even though not everybody speaks in English, you can get by quite well in India speaking English. So I'll just wrap up here. A couple of things. One is the way to think about, I think, what is happening with an economy, a society, in terms of economic growth, is what I call the three I's, ideas, interests, and institutions. India has strong institutions relatively strong. They've served it quite well, parliamentary democracy, court system that does some things well. It has an effective civil service. There are also issues, of course, of corruption and poor governance, but again, I think those can be are being dealt with. They're being recognized and dealt with. The second, interests. This has always been a problem in India. Competing interests, you know, whether it's labor and capital or different regional interests and so on, and that was perceived as one of the things holding India back. But in some respects, that's what's prevented labor laws from being reformed, where organized labor, which is a tiny percentage of the population, enjoys a lot of protection, but in that respect, it prevents employment from growing more rapidly. There are also industrialists can form interest groups and lobby for protection. That I think also can contribute to corruption. But on the whole, it seems to me that India has moved forward in terms of dealing with interest group competition and the constraints that place on growth. The third I is perhaps the most important, ideas. And I think there, again, one has seen a change, more gradual perhaps than in China, where India is, Indians realize that the path to economic growth is through greater market orientation and greater openness to the world economy. And there was, I think till the 80s, 70s and 80s, there was a great deal of suspicion of the market and a great deal of suspicion of the rest of the world, partly the result of, I think, India's colonial history. And that is dramatically changing, not completely. Late last year, there was a debate between two very prominent Indian economists, Amartya Sen, who has gotten a Nobel Prize in economics, and Jagdish Bhagwati, who is not as famous but also has done work comparable to Sen. And Sen said something like, well, this focus on economic growth is stupid. And I think that's actually a problem when a prominent intellectual says that, because without economic growth, you can get nothing. I mean, India is not at a level where it can treat economic growth as a luxury. Maybe we can in the United States or France, but certainly not in India. I think Bhagwati was right to question that. And the Indian government is in terms of ideas, is trying to deal with this by promoting the idea of inclusive growth. And in some sense, that is trying to create a new social contract which recognizes India's greater market orientation, less of a welfare state, but at the same time trying to provide some protections. And these, of course, are universal issues. They're being debated between Republicans and Democrats in the United States. They're being debated in every country in Europe and so on. But India needs growth. Just to give you an example, okay? I'll end. If India grows at 8% a year for 20 years, and I said that's pretty doable, barring real catastrophes, India's per capita income will triple, right? So that's subtracting off the effects of population growth. So just a little over three times will be India's per capita income after 20 years. That will get India to where China is now. China is not a rich country. So 8% growth, it's nice. Looking backward, it's great. But I think India has to really look forward to try to achieve 10% or even 12% growth, which was what Japan and Korea achieved in the 60s, and China has achieved year after year in the 90s and after. So with 12% growth in 20 years, India's per capita income will go up by a factor of close to 7. Still not rich, but a lot better than it is now. So, I think economic growth, this question of economic growth, in some senses it's dry, but I hope I've given you some of the human dimensions of that, and it's really absolutely critical for India to come up with economic policies that will support growth of faster than 8%. And I have to say the rest of the world isn't helping right now in achieving that. The United States in particular is not doing its bit. Okay, thank you.
Is this on? Good. Thank you very much for your comments here today. The floor is now open for questions. Please speak your questions into the microphone so that we can record your question. First hand back here.
Well, your delivery was very impressive, and from what I have observed superficially, the growth of India has been very impressive. But even though the United States has a vast underclass, proportionally India has even a larger one. What do you think policies India should take to address the vast underclass?
That's a really interesting question. And India has a challenge that the United States doesn't have in quite the same way, because India historically has, because of the caste system and other history, has been vertically very segmented and fragmented. In particular, the former untouchables that they now prefer to be called Dalits, basically meaning oppressed, they have really striven to enjoy the fruits of growth. And what has happened in India, very importantly over the last couple of decades, is that you see more and more of the erstwhile underclass taking political power because they have numbers. So the bigger states like Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, and so on have been ruled by lower caste politicians. What is interesting now is that there are actually Dalit entrepreneurs coming up, and a colleague of mine, Devesh Kapoor at the Center for Advanced Study of India at University of Pennsylvania, has done a major study on the Dalits. And it's interesting that actually the market orientation has allowed Dalits to flourish. And, of course, there have been quotas and reservations and so on, for professions and for government jobs and so on. And actually, this is something that another colleague of mine, Robert Fairley, in my department at UC Santa Cruz, has pointed out, that this is something where the United States actually does very poorly, where, for example, African Americans have had a pathway into the professions, into the middle class, but they haven't had a pathway to wealth through entrepreneurship because they don't have capital or access to capital. And this, I think, is actually something that, entrepreneurship is going to be a very important path towards social mobility in India. And that goes back to my broader theme that the government of India needs to have a set of policies that encourage new business creation for everybody.
My question also is about policy, but forward, backward-looking rather than forward-looking. In your informative talk, you did mention many of the manifestations of economic growth. But in terms of the policies that resulted in economic growth, you mentioned market orientation, tariff reduction. You mentioned the new laws that are now coming into effect, perhaps. But it's hard to believe that those alone resulted in the jump from 3 to 8%. I wonder if you could inform us further as to what else, what other policies the government may have adopted that has resulted in the growth.
Well, certainly before economic reform, India had invested in higher education. Those software entrepreneurs that have been very crucial to India's economic success, for example, were educated in Indian engineering colleges, most of them not abroad. I think India also pursued economic policies that maintained stability, and stability is extremely important for economic growth, law and order, and a feeling that you're not being left behind. I mean, who would have thought that you'd see the kind of riots we're seeing in England now? And that's really, I think, a symptom of a feeling of, well, you know, I'm just being completely left out of growth and the benefits of growth. So I think that sharing of the pie has been very important. But I think the Indian government took it to extremes. So at some level, if you take redistribution too far, you do hinder growth. And actually, a lot of India's move from 3-4% to 8-9% growth was simply by getting rid of restrictions. India had enormous restrictions on trade. 300% tariffs. Things were banned. You couldn't set up a factory without years of approvals. You'd have to wait. Years to get a telephone. Let me give you that example. There was a monopoly, a government monopoly in the telecom sector. So that is a fabulous example of just liberalization having a huge impact, allowing private firms to invest in telecom. So most people in India have never heard of landlines, right? They just went straight to mobile phones. And really, I think, I mean, this is maybe still oversimplifying, but I think just giving Indians a chance to create wealth, to do things that would create wealth, was really a major major change. And of course, you do have you need law and order, you need some kind of stability, and so on. And the Indian government, I think, achieved that. If you go to 1947 and partition, you could have had India could have ended up like Pakistan, right? Basically, Pakistan is a complete mess. Sorry if I'm offending any Pakistanis, but and many countries, ex-colonies, have ended up like that, and I think those political foundations for economic growth have been very important. So there's always a balance between state and market, between government and market, but India actually needs to do a little more liberalization, especially at the local level, and that's why one of the reasons why India's ease of doing business ranking is so poor, because you haven't had enough simplification of regulations at the local level. And again, there's trade-offs. You want to protect the environment and so on. Those are issues, but you can do it more efficiently than India is doing it now.
Thanks very much for being with us tonight. Can you characterize a little bit more about what the rise of the middle class income looks like? Is that a two-household income with 3 or 4 children, 1 car, 1 scooter? What does that look like for the typical Indian family?
Yeah. So middle class has an elastic definition depending on, if you define it something that would be, I think, understandable to somebody in the West, there's maybe 100 million Indians in the middle class. If you use a slightly broader definition, one can say maybe there's 300 million Indians in the middle class. And middle class really means people who see that there is a future for them. They want their children to do better than they will do. They have done. They'll invest in their children's schooling. Kinds of goods that the middle class buys, again, it depends on where you are in the middle class. One of the things that people in India have been buying, some of the durable goods that people in India have been buying at the lower end of the middle class, are just things like watches and bicycles and radios, and now then TVs and scooters, of course, and cars are still very much an upper middle class consumption item, but cell phones are very important now for people. You can get them very cheap in India. The You know, then white goods, which were very important, for example, in Japanese development, you know, air conditioners, coolers, refrigerators, those kinds of things. You know, so it's a classic pattern of development. So you get, you know, saving. You get some of it is on installment plans, and you know, some people in India, yes, are misusing credit cards and getting into debt, and you know, these are certainly issues that India has to deal with. But basically what you have is a solid middle class base that wants to save, and those savings are typically put into the you know, the banking sector, and the Indian banking sector is, you know, highly trusted. It's quite stable, and so that money then gets channeled, some of it gets channeled into investment. Indians are now also, you know, investing more in housing. 20 years ago, India didn't have the idea of mortgages. Basically, you saved all your life to have enough money to build a house, right? But now you can borrow money to build a house and pay it off over time, which is what we take for granted, but it didn't exist in India 20 years ago. So I think, you know, modern financial intermediation has helped the middle class in those things. If I don't answer a question precisely, I can always come back to it later. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for speaking with us tonight. I was curious, as the consumptive behavior of Indians increases, especially for the middle class, what kinds of policies are being done to lessen the environmental impact of that added consumption?
I think that's something that the Indian government has to still figure out. I mean, there are things like bans on plastic bags. Those are, you know, fairly easy to think of and implement in cities, though enforcing them is obviously a challenge. The real challenge, though, for environmental impacts is not so much at the consumption end. It's really at the production end, because India uses a lot of coal for energy. That's, you know, very damaging. There's a lot of, you know, waste which is not treated, dumped into water. So I think that the point in the value chain where the Indian government needs to figure things out better is really in production and you know, imposing environmental regulations in production. And I think that's quite going to be a struggle for India, just as it has been for every country in that has developed. I mean, whether you look at Britain in the 19th century with its, you know, thick fogs, which were basically pollution, or China now, or, you know, Japan in the 60s. So hopefully India will be able to do some leapfrogging here also, you know, implement some kind of clean tech and so on. I mean, I feel like this is something where the whole world is kind of behind the curve in terms of environmental remediation.
Yeah, you mentioned in closing that the world economy is not helping India. And, you know, what's going to happen with, you know, Bernanke forecasting at least 2 years of no growth in the United States, Europe with the banks and they have their own problems, China is slowing their economy, and Japan's doing nothing. So you're looking at a world extremely weak for 2 years and maybe many more. How is that going to affect India, and what could the Indian government do on their own if the world economy is extremely weak for years to come?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, especially compared to China, India is much less dependent on exports, but obviously slowdown in the U.S. economy is going to hurt segments of the Indian economy, for example, software and IT-enabled services. If you look at what happened in the financial crisis in 2008, India's growth rate slowed from over 9% to 6.7%, I think, around that. So you can think of that as, okay, so maybe India will grow at 7%, 7.5% for a year or two. But in a lot of Indian growth is based on domestic consumption. The proportion of consumption in India's gross national product is much greater than in China, for example. It's much less reliant on exports. So I think in that sense, India has more, you know, built-in stabilizers. So when I said 8%, yeah, you know, it might be 7, might be below, a little below 8% for a couple of years. But as long as, you know, Indian households are willing to save and that money is, you know, productively invested, we're looking at, you know, ratios of 30 to 35% of GDP, I think then, you know, 7, 8% growth is you know, reasonable. And again, the challenge is getting beyond that to double-digit growth. So, you know, it's not great, but it could be worse, I think. And I think actually China may actually have some more to worry about. Plus, they're holding $3 trillion of, you know, U.S. Treasuries, which India only has a couple of hundred billion. Yeah. So I think, yeah, I think the Chinese should worry more about what's happening in the U.S. And they are, right?
Thanks for being here again. I have a quick question on the macroeconomics of the current account and the fiscal account. Because mm-hmm. India still runs current account deficits, and then the fiscal account is, you know, the proportion of FDI to, you know, portfolio money, which we consider hot money, is weighted more towards hot money. So is that a cause for concern given the... and then the second question that I have is related to social mobility and what you talked about, education. So I think education is one way of kind of empowering people through social mobility, which is happening. But education access is a huge problem. And like you said, we're reaping this population dividend. And unless we really make sure that we have an education infrastructure in place, it might be a problem. So what do you think the solution looks like? Is it a technological solution in terms of access? Or is it a free market solution? Because even though you have private schools, they can't make a profit. So if it becomes like a for-profit system, do you think that would help?
Okay. Two very big questions. So I'll give you brief answers, and you know they may not be complete. But yes, obviously education is hugely important for India, and its population is, I think, undereducated. I think some of that has been the result of government policies. So I think greater private provision of education and increasing access through technology, there's a huge opportunity there that actually is being tapped by a lot of firms in India now that they're being allowed to do that. It's amazing that you know, even poor people in India are willing to pay. They will pay to send their children to private schools rather than to government schools, because the government schools are free, but the teacher doesn't show up. And so, you know, they'll really dip into their pockets to pay for their children to go to private schools. So I think you can't make a huge amount of money necessarily unless you really scale it up. But I think there is room for private provision of education. And what India obviously needs is a better system of financial aid for disadvantaged people. You know, and we have the Pell Grants here, for example. With respect to capital flows and the current accounts, so there's trade balances, right, with exports, imports for non-economists, and then there's you know, other kinds of current transfers. So, for example, India gets a lot of remittances from Indians abroad, especially from, not so much from the United States, actually. Workers in the Middle East, Indian workers in the Middle East, send a huge amount of money back to India. And that's actually very important for India's balance of payments. But that shows up in the current account. So India is running a current account deficit, so is the United States. That means that it has to cover that difference with capital inflows, right? Basically, and you can do that by borrowing. So the United States borrows, right? It issues treasuries. Everybody's willing to hold treasuries, that has been up to now. But actually most, I mean, nobody buys Indian government debt, right? There's a lot of portfolio flows into India. People are buying shares of Indian companies. Now, you can call that hot money, and it does flow in and out. But really, I think it's actually not that pernicious to have equity investment, because in some sense, see, when you're borrowing from foreigners, you have a fixed obligation, right? And you have to pay them whether you're making money or not, right? So that's when you get into trouble. That's what got Latin America into trouble, was it basically had fixed interest obligations to the rest of the world. With equity, if your stock market goes down, then the foreigners lose and you lose, but that's all right. I mean, that's you're sharing the pain, and that's what equity is about, right? You take the risk, you share the risk. So I'm actually not that worried about hot money.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for one last quick question.
Thank you. And thank you again for speaking here today. So India is a country with 1.5 billion people around there. You mentioned...
1.2,
sorry. You mentioned that the largest state was the size of Brazil. You mentioned states that are the size of European countries. Given that size, I mean, how does, so you speak of an 8% growth rate, and the question is, where is that 8%? How is this spread about? How does the size and the demographics play into the growth rates and the policies?
There's no simple answer in the sense that there's actually been changes over time. So some richer states have grown faster, like in the West and South. Other rich states like Punjab have actually grown slower than the average. And recently Bihar, which is one of the poorest states, has been growing very rapidly. So on the average, you've been getting greater regional inequality. But what the people of India are seeing is that that's not a consequence of initial conditions. It's really a consequence of governance. So what this is one of the great things about Indian democracy is that people have figured out that they want politicians, that politicians can actually make a difference in terms of their economic well-being, and they're very clearly voting for politicians who they see as making a difference. Now, this, there will always be an issue, I think, with cities growing faster and urbanized populations. There are people in India who have a lifestyle which is similar to that in the West. But some regional disparities will always be there. New York is different from Appalachia, for example, and always will be. So I would say that there are issues there. They are being dealt with to the extent that the Indian government can deal with them. And it's one of the challenges, it's fomenting, for example, contributing to the Maoist unrest, but it's not insurmountable, I'd say.
Thank you very much, Dr. Singh. Please, let's give Dr. Singh a hand.
Thank you.
We also thank our audience here as well as our audience listening to the recording. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.